There we are. We made it back. We're a couple of moments early tonight. Welcome to everyone. Hello, David. Hello, Trish and Van. Thank you for your kind comments. It's been exhausting, I'll tell you. I hope this is the last move until the Lord takes us. Then He can move us. How's that for a moving sentiment? Anyway, it's I don't know, it's about 80 degrees here. We got up to 95 today with high humidity, but nothing like Texas. And I wanted to start off by just echoing what Kathleen and all of you have said in band regarding the flooding in Texas and the loss of life. This is definitely weather warfare, weather manipulation, weather engineering, geoengineering, as Dane Wigginton calls it. These kinds of things just don't happen. And I think, as Kathleen mentioned in band, and she and I were talking about as we watched the news yesterday, we are in the tribulation. I mean, it's not isolated to just Texas. These events are going on all over the world. So I think there's more than enough evidence that we are in the tribulation. Please keep the families in prayer and all those that have been affected. It's heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking to see the loss of life, and especially when it involves children as it has. Tonight, the title of this live stream is Bricks Bank versus Swift. It is July 6th. It is Sunday. As a programming note, I mentioned in the last live stream on Thursday, because of our change in residence and our move, we are taking Tuesday night off, if you will. It sounds odd to say I'm taking the night off. It, you know, we just get together as friends and talk. So Tuesday, we're not getting together. Thursday, I plan to do a live stream, but as is typical with technology and starting new internet service, and we are expecting in the morning on Thursday to receive our new modem, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm not banking on the fact that it's going to happen on Thursday that we will have internet service. So we may need to postpone until Friday or even Sunday, just to give you the heads up. Also, we are unpacking and all of those good things that are involved with that process. So we may need to postpone until Sunday. But it just depends on how things are progressing from Tuesday going forward. So thank you for your patience and your understanding with that in mind. I did mention that our new residence is in a quiet neighborhood. We are moving considerably further north, but the neighborhood itself is quiet. They don't allow trucks. I doubt we will even hear a motorcycle there. So it's going to be a welcome change for not only Kathleen and myself and our animals, but for you as well. And we'll have a quiet environment to sit down and have our conversations. And I think that's the way it should be. But tonight I want to talk about BRICS. BRICS held their meeting on the 4th and 5th of July BRICS held their summit meeting in Brazil on the 4th and 5th, so today is the 6th. So I do want to spend some time talking about the discussions that took place there, the ramifications, the implications for you and I. This isn't just limited to the global impact at the higher levels of banking and finance, but it also affects us. There is a trickle-down effect. But I do want to begin with a little bit of biology. I am very pleased to see that we have new subscribers. I have been receiving emails from new subscribers that have been asking about the Mark of the Beast. It's evident that they haven't had the opportunity to watch previous videos or to go through Entangle magazine. And I'm not going to spend really any time talking about the Mark of the Beast other than it is a genetic modifier, the vaccine for SARS-CoV-2. The modifications to the human genome are permanent. The human genome, in particular, the DNA in its sequence, its God-designed, God-given design, is our name. And when you change the human genome, change the DNA sequence, then you are changing a person's God-given name. Thus, their name is no longer found in the Book of Life. That is the Mark of the Beast. As we often do, we look back to somewhat recent history for evidence of what they're doing today and what they did 5 years ago. And this is the in silico DNA, in silico design and redesign genetic modification of DNA that I want to share with you again as a piece of evidence, so-called smoking gun, that in fact this was an in silico and in software process that designed both the virus and the subsequent vaccines based upon the genomic sequence of messenger RNA. So let's go back to 2008. Genome-based vaccine development, a shortcut for the future. This was authored by Danilo Morel, dated 2008, published in Human Vaccines in 2008. So this is peer-reviewed. I'm not going to read it extensively. What I want to focus on, what I want to highlight, is something that we have published extensively about in Entangled Magazine, and that is reverse vaccinology. Remember, I've described this as reverse engineering of a virus, and in this case, SARS-CoV-1, which is the predecessor to 2, that results in the disease COVID-19. I described to you the process, scientific process, of reverse engineering a virus in order to produce a vaccine. In the case of SARS-CoV-2, they first created the virus, a novel coronavirus. All of you have your PhDs. We've covered this for 5 years. In this case, they began with a designer virus. And having designed it, they could then produce a vaccine. They could produce multiple types of vaccines, subunit vaccines, monoclonal vaccines, strict messenger RNA vaccines enveloped in a lipid nanoparticle. They could develop these vaccines by taking the original genomic sequence that they created in a computer to produce the virus. They can then take that genomic sequence and produce the vaccines from it. That's the in silico process that we've described. What I want to share from this paper is that if you have just the organism, and in this case they're talking primarily in this paper about bacteria, but they also bring up viruses, but bacterial pathogens, disease causing organisms is a pathogen. The process of reverse engineering or reverse vaccinology is equally applicable to bacteria as it is to vaccines. When they begin with a living organism, bacteria or a virus. Now, a virus is not classified as a living organism until it actually infects a living cell, a host cell. Then it is considered to be a living organism. But let's just consider for a superficial broad stroke conversation. We have two types of living organisms, bacteria and viral. When you sequence the genome, when you look at the order of the genes and identify individual genes and the activities of those individual genes, predominant activity being the expression of one or more types of proteins, you can take that sequence of that living organism and apply that sequence to the construct, the laboratory in silico, and we'll read that in here, the laboratory creation of a vaccine based upon the information known as bioinformatics. Again, we've covered this extensively, but bioinformatics is the information derived from the genome. The information begins with the sequence of that genome, and then the identity of the genes, and then the identity of the proteins. We could certainly go to the base pair nucleotides, but let's keep it very brief here tonight. So bioinformatics provides you the information of the genetics of an organism. When you have that information, you can then design a vaccine, and the vaccine is typically intended to produce one or more proteins. So when we say a vaccine, whether it's for bacteria or a virus or multiple viruses, you are looking for the production of specific proteins by that organism. If it is a disease-causing organism, then it is a pathogenic organism. So that pathogen produces, has as part of its makeup, certain proteins. The reason for those proteins within the context of talking about producing a vaccine is that the proteins, being the action items of the body, are the action items of the pathogen. Thus, they are the action items of the disease that arises from the actions of the pathogen. The reason there is the focus on proteins is proteins are antigens in the discussion of disease. In other words, they are the target for the immune system to recognize those proteins, recognize that they're novel to the organism, to the body of the animal, body of the person. The immune system says, oh, I haven't seen that before. So I'm going to produce, because it's a novel disease, a novel antibody. Now, if it is something that the body has seen before, it's even better equipped because it has dormant antibodies that can quickly reproduce and mount an attack on those proteins, on those antigens. Antigens are just targets for the immune system. Thus, to identify the targets, you identify the proteins. In order to identify the proteins, you must identify the genes that produce those proteins. And in order to identify the organism itself, the pathogen, you must identify the order of those genes and the individual genes themselves. In other words, the sequence of that genome, the sequence of that organism. By first having that sequence from the organism, you can then reverse engineer that organism, that pathogen, and produce a gene-based vaccine. What I'm going to read to you is from 2008. So this whole thing about, oh, you know, this is a novel coronavirus, never seen it before, it came from a pangolin, it came from the wet market. No, the discussion is the Wuhan lab and gain-of-function research and Anthony Fauci and so forth and so on, and that this is the reverse engineering of a known pathogen, a coronavirus pathogen, SARS-CoV-1, the cousin to 2. There was gain-of-function research going on for about 10 years on coronaviruses themselves. So without further ado, I'm going to read from this paper, Reverse Vaccinology. That's one of the subsections from the paper. The sequencing of the first bacterium genome in 1995 led the vaccine development, that movement of vaccine development, to enter a new era and to open a new chapter in the vaccine development guidebook. So, that's my opening. I want to read from Wikipedia regarding 1995, and Dr. Craig Venter, whom I've cited here many times, even before COVID, I mentioned the work of Dr. Craig Venter, whom personally I consider one of the most evil individuals on the planet. Okay? I just put it right out there. Okay. Dr. Craig Venter published the genome of the first free living organism in 1995. I'm reading from Wikipedia. The genomes of other microorganisms became more readily available throughout the end of the 20th century. Reverse vaccinology, designing vaccines using the pathogen's sequenced genome, came from this new wealth of genomic information as well as technological advances. The reason that I put the label of evil on Dr. Craig Venter and his associates is that up until 1995, you could not create the mark of the beast. Venter's early research and accomplishments provided what I like to call the infrastructure for the mark of the beast. We would not have COVID if it was not for Craig Venter, because the technology, the reverse vaccinology process of developing the vaccines that change the DNA, we can put in side-by-side cells, or in the same cell, I'm not talking biological cells, I'm talking about incarceration. Dr. Anthony Fauci, who hijacked the research into HIV by Dr. Luc Montagnier, Anthony Fauci stole his research, for which Montagnier received the Nobel Prize, and Fauci set about putting together a program to weaponize HIV, which is included in SARS-CoV-2. Dr. Craig Venter developed the sequencing technology, the infrastructure to sequence the genome of bacteria and then viruses and then the human genome. Remember the Human Genome Project? That's all Craig Venter. This whole in silico process, what I've referred to over 10 years ago as the digitizing of DNA. That's the converting of the DNA pattern, the identity of the genes, the identity of the proteins into digital information, into a digital code that could be transmitted through the internet, through the cloud, and reproduce that same organism using a biological printer to output the chemicals necessary to create the DNA, to then create the sequence, to then recreate the organism by placing that bioprinted material in E. coli and grow it in the laboratory. All of that came from Dr. Craig Venter. So he and Fauci should be sharing the same cell as far as I'm concerned. Reverse vaccinology is much more efficient than traditional vaccinology, which requires growing large amounts of specific microorganisms as well as extensive wet lab tests. In 2000, the J. Craig Venter Institute developed the first vaccine using reverse vaccinology. The J. Craig Venter Institute and others then continued work on other vaccines. So, 1995. That really was the start of what we've been dealing with now for 5 years. Suddenly, all proteins encoded by a microorganism were available. And for the first time, after more than two centuries, it was possible to identify vaccine candidates without using the conventional vaccinology principles. So I'm back reading this peer-reviewed paper. This new approach, named reverse vaccinology, gives full access to all the proteins that a microorganism can encode, and by computer analysis, it is possible to identify potential surface-exposed proteins, such as a spike protein, okay, surface-exposed. That's a coronavirus, folks. In a reverse manner, starting from the genome rather than the microorganism. We'll get to the in silico being cited here in just a second. Problems related to non-cultivatable, in other words, you can't cultivate, microorganisms, and also to antigens that are not expressed in the in vitro conditions, conferring the most important obstacles for vaccine development, could be avoided by the reverse vaccinology approach. In other words, you don't have to cultivate the microorganisms in the lab. You don't have to produce the actual antigens, the target proteins. Okay? That's very difficult with certain organisms, complex organisms. Okay? So with reverse vaccinology, you don't need to go through those difficult steps. Of course, that shortens the timeline for the development of a vaccine, which we all saw in early 2020. The feasibility of this approach relies on the availability of a high-throughput system for protective immunity screening and also on good correlates of protection. The greatest limitation of the reverse vaccinology approach is the inability in identifying non-protein antigens, such as polysaccharides, and components of many successful vaccines and glycolipids, a new promising group of vaccine candidates. Nevertheless, reverse vaccinology seemed to be a powerful tool that could help researchers to overcome the obstacles of conventional vaccinology and lead to the discovery and development of novel vaccines for the most concerning emerging diseases. That's COVID. That's the foundation of COVID. That's the beginning of the development of COVID, right there. It's reverse vaccinology. Let me find this very quickly. Just looking for something in here. I'm scanning through. I like to give you excerpts rather than reading a whole bunch. Let's see. After sequencing the first genome in 1995, again, that's Dr. Craig Venter, but I'm reading from the paper, great efforts have been concentrated in the determination of the genome sequences of other pathogenic bacteria that could lead to the development of a novel vaccines based on the reverse vaccinology approach. Comparative genome analysis of pathogenic strains have concentrated their efforts in comparing pathogenic strains of a species, looking for the identification of antigens that could lead to a maximum coverage in a universal vaccine. Okay. Anyway, I think that's enough of the biology for tonight, except to just say 1995 began the whole process towards 2019 and the public acknowledgement of the novel coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2. We've produced many other papers similar to this one that have shown the origins of this entire in silico process. Reverse vaccinology, bioinformatics, this is all software-driven biology. That's what in silico is. That's what I refer to as the digitizing of DNA. And look what it's brought us. I was just reviewing one of the latest seminars in preparation tonight for this short biological discussion, a seminar on long COVID. We're 5 years plus into this thing. They still do not have a causal factor for long COVID. Nowhere in the seminar did they bring up the fact that spike protein is overproduced by the vaccines and is continuously overproduced, and that it is found in nearly every organ in the deceased individual. They did acknowledge that it is found where it should not be found, which is the crossing of the blood-brain barrier and finding spike protein in the brain, but also in the testes and the ovaries, which also have their own blood barriers to prevent organisms from infecting those areas. But they don't even go to what we've presented in the papers here of this over abundance of spike protein. That's the reason for long COVID. It's because you cannot remove from the body. There is no treatment. There's no modality. There's no mechanism available. And there never will be. By design, there never will be any ability to rid the body of spike protein. So long COVID is here as an endemic situation. It means it's ingrained. It's chronic. It's here forever until the Lord returns. But they still, at least publicly in these seminars, they will not acknowledge what I just said to you. And I think that's part of the reason that you even listen to myself and Kathleen, is that we go to the scientific papers where there are quietly, even peer-reviewed in journals, but thus quietly, not really reaching the public domain, so to speak, quietly published evidence that is peer-reviewed that says this is why long COVID is still here. It's all about spike protein. That's by design. That's why it's the mark of the beast. One and done. Once marked, that's it. I don't care what other people are saying. I really don't. There are people out there that are pushing curatives and treatments and pills and potions and lotions and all kinds of nonsense out there. I don't care. I think they're all snake oil salesmen. Because they're not basing their claims on evidence, on facts. Anyway, that's enough of the biology. Let's talk about bricks, because we talked about in the last live stream the president's Reconciliation Act, and the fact that what is buried in that is the moratorium for 5 years prohibiting the states in the United States from passing any legislation that would in any manner impede the development of artificial intelligence, which includes the building and development of data centers, in particular the Stargate project. The Reconciliation Act that he signed on the 4th of July raises the debt ceiling. This brings us into BRICS. I still maintain, I've been saying this for a couple of months now, I still maintain that at some point, President Trump is going to acknowledge to the world that the U.S. Federal Reserve's cryptocurrency has been tested now for more than 3 years with BRICS, that they have been running simulations of settlements of cross-border international transactions using only cryptocurrencies, individual sovereign cryptocurrencies from individual nations, their own unique crypto for each nation, including the U.S., that the U.S. has been testing along with those other nations for over 3 years with the Bank for International Settlements. And now what I want to introduce to you, which was announced in the BRICS summit in Brazil, that all of the current, there are 10 current active member nations of BRICS, have now endorsed what they call the New Development Bank, the NDB. Now, this has been around. We've talked about it. What is different here is that rather than focusing on the BIS, the Bank for International Settlements, which today is utilizing SWIFT, which is the current system for settling cross-border transactions, utilizing the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency, in the settlement of transaction. That just means the balancing of the books. Replacing SWIFT with the new development bank, and at the same time displacing the World Bank and replacing it with the new development bank. Without getting too far into the details right at this moment, I want to keep it big perspective, big picture. President Trump, in the role that he is playing, the script that he's been given, mandates that he will acknowledge that the United States has been a de facto member of BRICS. It's just a matter of timing as to when that is revealed to the world. What I'm stressing is that, again, we've published the evidence to what I'm saying. Remember the Big Bang cutover by the European Central Banks? That involved moving from analog to digital transactions. Back then, 3+ years ago, when we talked about it, that included laying out for you all of the simulated transactions between the central banks, not only in Europe, but including the United States. See, the Federal Reserve sets banking policy for the European central banks, because the European central banks, they get their liquidity in dollars, they get their credit, they get their guaranteed loans from the United States. All of that mechanism, all of that infrastructure, and the testing of that infrastructure that was all based on cryptocurrencies between the European central banks and the US, all of that funnels into BRICS. So it doesn't matter if you hear people saying, this is going to destroy the dollar, this is going to lock Western European and US financial institutions and businesses out of doing business with the BRICS members. Hardly. BRICS is nothing more than the, call it the codification. Something Trump likes to say a lot. We're going to codify this. That means they're just going to write it into law. You're going to take a program and you're going to codify it. You're going to enable it to receive funding. To codify BRICS as the only financial system under the Antichrist. That's all BRICS is. It's the lead up to the Antichrist taking control of commerce. This is Mark of the Beast, no man might buy or sell. All the infrastructure, all the blockchain, all the crypto, everything we've talked about for years. So you cannot have an Antichrist ruling and reigning over 8 billion people who have taken the Mark of the Beast, while at the same time excluding Europe and excluding the United States from that economic system. That's not how it works with a single global leader with a single cryptocurrency. Therefore, BRICS is setting the stage. It is the stepping stone to the Antichrist global economic system. Therefore, logically, the United States, President Trump, must at some point in the very near future acknowledge that the U.S. has always been, since BRICS began, it's now almost 10 years, has always been a part of BRICS, but it's been kept in the background, purposefully kept in the background. Now, I've said in the last live stream, and I'll say it again here tonight, watch Japan. watched Japan with regard to their bond market, and more specifically, whether Japan this week participates in the 3-year, 10-year, and 30-year bond purchases in the auction by the Fed. It's actually a treasury auction. Okay, if you want the long details, go back to the last live stream on Thursday. The point is, this week is very critical to the bond market because Treasury is trying to auction more debt bonds. While at the same time, last week, President Trump on Air Force One was saying Japan has enjoyed a really sweet deal with the United States for far too long. I'm paraphrasing. He did say sweet deal. And therefore, he is threatening. He's put Japan on notice that there will be tariffs. So how does Japan respond to tariffs? They say, we're not going to buy any more of your debt. And Japan is the largest holder of US debt on the planet, followed by United Kingdom, and China is number three. So when you play this tariff game, then you trigger a response. If the US government is unable to find sufficient buyers, which means the bond market itself, US domestic banks by policy having to buy unsold bonds in the auction, and the remainders are picked up by the Fed, the Federal Reserve, to make it appear as if the auction was successful, which it hasn't been for several auctions in a row. Therefore, it is smoke and mirrors. They're just propping up the bond market. And they have for several years now propped it up with this game of buying unsold bonds. Trump, it astounded me when he said this last week, threatening Japan. Really, in terms of buying US debt, they are the best ally that the United States have. And he's threatening them with tariffs. Now, a lot of times he'll just throw something and see if it'll stick on the wall to get a reaction out of people, to generate a conversation or even a debate. He just throws things out there. So that may be what this threat of tariffs was all about. It may be the inverse principle. It may simply be him saying, Japan, next week, you buy our bonds, you buy a lot of our bonds, or I'm going to slap tariffs on you. I think that is the reason that he publicly made that threat known to the media that are on Air Force One. Buy our debt, or we will slap tariffs on you, is what the president was threatening Japan with. I know I'm repeating myself. I just want to drive that home because I think that was really the reason for him saying that. But if we go back to the beginning, if that was not what he was trying to accomplish, meaning inducing Japan to buy our debt, if he's just throwing it out there and threatening them, then they're going to respond and say, we're not going to buy your debt. That will destroy the bond market. That will put the US government into default status. The US domestic banks and the Federal Reserve do not have sufficient liquidity to buy up the entire quantity of bonds that need to be auctioned this week. In fact, as I've been reading the reports, most investors are unwilling to buy 30-year bonds or 10-year bonds or even 3-year bonds because they have no faith in the credit of the US government. So they're buying 1 week bonds, 6 month bonds, 1 year bonds, if they're buying any at all. So this week is a very tenuous situation. So let's say if we go to the brink of, with the US government, the brink of default. What if we go to the brink of the bond market collapsing and then default is subsequent to that collapse? What if over the course of the next few days we see a high likelihood that the bond market is not only unstable, but it might cease trading by any nation? My hypothesis is this: it might be enough of an excuse, not an inducement, not a causal factor. It may be enough of an excuse, the excuse by design that the president needs to say that the United States is joining BRICS. He doesn't necessarily have to go and say, we've been a member of BRICS and we've been testing the crypto. It's enough for him to just come out, maybe this week, and say, the United States, I'm the greatest deal maker on the planet, and I just made a deal with BRICS. And the United States has joined BRICS. Now, why would he do that? Why would he say that? Why would that be part of the plan? Because the Antichrist system has to have all of the nations coming together. It has to happen at some point. He can blame bonds. He can blame Japan if he wants to. But he has to say, in order to prevent the collapse of the bond market, and again, he doesn't have to go to say, to the point of saying, to prevent the United States government from defaulting on its obligations. He'll never say that. He'll simply say, so the average person, the average, Joe Bag of Donuts, we haven't talked about him for a long time, understands something like, oh, we have to join BRICS so that the bond market doesn't collapse. Whatever that means, okay, I guess sounds like a good thing, Mr. President. Yay, we're part of BRICS. And then he goes off down the street to the liquor store. I know I'm being ridiculous. But so is this financial system. It is absolutely ridiculous. Now, I can be completely wrong about everything that I just said. I think it's worth considering. Let us look at a couple of things here. SWIFT, the Society for Worldwide Bank Interbank Financial Telecommunication. It is a cooperative established in 1973 in Belgium and owned by the banks and other member firms that use its service. SWIFT provides the main messaging network through which international payments are initiated. It also sells software and services to financial institutions, mostly for use on its proprietary SwiftNet. Before SWIFT's establishment, international financial transactions were communicated over Telex, a public system involving manual writing and reading of messages. SWIFT was set up out of fear of what might happen if a single private or fully American entity controlled global financial flows, which before was the First National City Bank of New York, later Citibank. SWIFT was founded in Brussels on the 3rd of May of 1973. Individuals who played a key role in its creation included bankers, and I won't list all those guys. Okay. Here's what we need to know. SWIFT acts as a carrier of the messages containing the payment instructions between financial institutions involved in a transaction. Okay? The New Development Bank was set up primarily by members of BRICS, but it predated BRICS, the New Development Bank. This is mostly in Southeast Asia. But the New Development Bank operates the same way that SWIFT does, for the same purpose. But they go beyond just the settlement of transactions. They also guarantee very large mega loans, long-term loans, for large infrastructure projects. The New Development Bank does that, okay? The result of the New Development Bank providing to the member nations of BRICS an alternative to SWIFT means that they can settle transactions between member nations in BRICS, settle it through the New Development Bank, and cut out SWIFT and cut out the dollar as the reserve currency. This then allows BRICS members using the New Development Bank to use their existing sovereign currencies in trade between member nations. And as they move to their cryptocurrencies, the use of their cryptocurrencies to settle their transactions within BRICS members. This is a threat to the US dollar. All 10 members, and there are associate members and observer members like Turkey to BRICS, but all 10 current members of BRICS just announced at their summit in Brazil over the 4th and 5th that they are using the New Development Bank exclusively as their hub for their cross-border international trade. They've thrown down the gauntlet and said, we're no longer using SWIFT. We're no longer using the dollar. SWIFT is the dollar as reserve currency. Now, if it wasn't bad enough looking at the bond situation, we now look at the dollar situation. You see, as a reserve currency, that helps to prop up the purchasing power, the quote value of the dollar on the international market, when member nations say, we don't need the dollar. That then reduces the purchasing power, the perceived value, and the perceived strength of the dollar. In the commodity markets, the purchasing power drops. In the currency markets, the value of the dollar relative to other currencies drops. And countries like it when the dollar is weak, when the dollar drops, because they do not need to provide more of their sovereign currency in exchange for the dollars. Now, at least the members of BRICS don't need the dollar at all. Again, this is destroying the full faith and confidence in the US government, in the currency. As the dollar drops in purchasing power, what that means to you and I is that if we buy imported goods, and we don't even need to talk about tariffs or sanctions, just wanting to buy something that is imported into the US domestic market, when the dollar is weaker, it costs more in terms of dollars. It raises the price of foreign goods that are sold domestically here in the U.S. This is why we pay attention to BRICS, because it affects the dollar. The other thing that comes about when you now have a hub, the Bank for New Development Bank, as the BRICS Bank, as it is now officially known, the BRICS Bank is, you no longer have concern about the U.S. imposing sanctions on BRICS members. It devalues the sanctions because the dollar is devalued. Sanctions are only relevant when the international trade is being conducted and settled using the reserve currency dollar. When you knock out the dollar and you knock out SWIFT as the organization that's settling the trade, then you end up with a situation where sanctions have zero effect on those member nations. For you and I, what this means is that if the U.S. does not have the lever, the leverage, the big hammer of sanctions, what's the alternative when you're trying to influence other nations? Military, war. If you can't hurt somebody or influence somebody or manipulate somebody economically, then that brings in the military. That's what it means to you and I. Okay. I think we'll keep tonight relatively short. I think you can appreciate that Kathleen and I have been pretty wiped out here with everything that we're scrambling to do. Tomorrow is our last day to clean the house and make it nice for the new owners. So we're working on that tonight and tomorrow. So I think we'll cut this live stream short. I don't have the energy to go for an hour and a half or 2 hours tonight. I apologize. But I leave you with these thoughts. Let's pay attention to Japan, to the bond market, and any subsequent announcements coming out of BRICS over the course of this week. And maybe the president will admit, will announce that we, the United States, are joining BRICS. That would be a huge announcement. The U.S., what would the U.S. gain? What would the U.S. gain by joining BRICS? It's all about trade. Brazil, a lot of agriculture trade. Brazil is really the largest exporter of agricultural goods on the planet. So there's Brazil, there's Russia, there's India, there's China, South Africa. The United States cannot afford, in terms of trade, we cannot afford to be isolated from BRICS. We need to be engaged in trade with BRICS. I'm only speaking economically, I'm not speaking spiritually. we need to engage and trade with these major economic forces. And that's enough to bring the president to make a deal. I'll leave you with Proverbs 19, verse 17. Kindness to the poor is a loan to the Lord, and he will repay the lender. Kindness to the poor is a loan to the Lord, and he will repay the lender. God bless you all, and good night.